For Motorsport.com and Ultra Magazine, I'm Kevin Turner, and this is your sport podcast. Well, it won't have escaped your attention that Formula One is celebrating 75 years of the World Drivers' Championship, and we thought it could be fun to pick out the best seasons of those 75 years. And instead of me poring over videos, articles and books forever and a day and coming up with a list that everyone else disagrees with anyway, I'll just get some special guests in to pick their favourite season and they can explain why they think it's the best season, and then we can have a debate about it that way. So I'm very pleased to welcome our first special guest in this series, Karun Chandhok. Welcome to the Autosport Podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good. And very excited to get stuck in.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this should be quite good good fun. So, because we just talk about stuff that we like, which is good. So, just briefly, which season have you gone for, and why? What's the crux of it?
I picked 1997 because I feel like as a kid growing up, that was, you know, I was an F1 fan watching it out in India. And it was just one of these mad seasons where every weekend you had no idea what was going to happen. You had an unbelievable title decider, very intense title decider, controversial. So I think, yeah, if you're going to pick one, you know, your all-time greatest season, it's got to have that, hasn't it? It's got to have a championship battle that goes to the last race. It's got to have a bit of a rivalry. It's got to have some random results. And yeah. I think it's got all that.
I think that's fair. You want lots of different winners, a coherent championship fight, as you say. Also, the cars. Like, yeah. The cars have got to be kind of cool. I do think 97, there are a couple of really good looking cars. I think McLaren and the Jordan look good. And V10 sounded nice.
Yeah, and you had cool stories like Stewart Grand Prix arriving and then finishing on the podium in the Monaco Grand Prix. I mean, you had nine teams finishing on the podium that year. Let's think about that. I mean, in a modern world of F1, imagine if we had all but one of the teams finishing on the podium at some point that season. It'd be amazing. And that's what we had in 1997.
It was an entertaining season. So just to look at some of the sort of basic stats to back up what Karun's saying, there were six winners for four different teams. Jacques Villeneuve, who obviously won the World Championship, won seven races. Mark Schumacher, who doesn't appear in the final results in the Championship, but actually was second with five wins. David Coulthard from McLaren scored a couple. And then Heinz-Harald Frentzen, we'll get to him, I'm sure. Mika Häkkinen and Gerhard Berger scored a win apiece. But I think perhaps the more telling stat for the competitiveness of the teams, at least in terms of sheer speed, Villeneuve had 10 of the 17 pole positions, and Williams had a pace advantage of 0.6%, which in 2025 would be enough to see you win basically every race.
Yeah, but I think the favourite stat from that season for me is the fact that Schumacher and Villeneuve finished, forget Schumacher's disqualification, but finished within 3 points of each other, right? 81 versus 78. Frentzen only had 42 points, so just over half of what Villeneuve had. But Schumacher and Villeneuve never finished on the podium together. How mad is that?
I mean, that would never happen again. How can that happen? I mean, I suppose that's the one thing it lacks, is there's not that many wheel-to-wheel fights between the two of them, because it would be one of them takes a few race wins and turns, and then it swings back the other way.
Yeah, but then we had Jerez, and that made up for everything.
Okay, that's fair enough. Well, actually, let's get into that now then, because that raises an interesting point. So I looked up the Autocourse and Autosport top 10 drivers, because I think that's a good place to, discussion point. So Autocourse went for Jacques Villeneuve number one, Mark Schumacher second, which I would suggest is they've taken the moral high ground there.
Yeah.
Whereas Autosport went for Mark Schumacher first and Jacques Villeneuve second, which is very much a results and performance driven list, I would suggest. So which one, before I say which one I think I would go with, which one would you go with?
But you've got higher morals than I have.
Well, I don't know. Honestly, I would put Schumacher number one.
Oh, so would I.
He was so far ahead in terms.
Like, yes.
Villeneuve made, I was pleased after lap 48 of the European Grand Prix that the Williams held together and Villeneuve did win the World Championship. But up to that point, I was team Schumacher because I thought he had done a much better job with his kit than Villeneuve had done with his.
Yeah. Basically. No, I agree. I think it's hard to argue that, isn't it? There's, you get to the first race of the year in Melbourne and Villeneuve's like 1.7 seconds ahead of the first non-Williams or something, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I was looking this up. So the so the gap was 1.7 seconds between Villeneuve and Frentzen.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, even more.
The fastest non-Williams, which was Schumacher's Ferrari on that occasion, was 2.1 seconds off, which now you're well out of Q1. Like you've gone already.
Yeah, we're talking about 1 second the whole field, aren't we? Yeah. So it's half the gap of that. So to go from there to Schumacher fighting for the championship right down to the end, and you think of the amazing fightbacks when he went on that run, didn't he, in the middle of the year where Monaco, Canada, and Magny-Cours, where he won those races in the middle of the season. Schumacher was in tremendous form. And there were times where you thought the Ferrari was just destroying its tyres. Budapest, classic example, wasn't it? He just blistered and destroyed the tyres. Barcelona was another one where the Ferrari was just destroying its tyres. And Villeneuve won at a canter from Olivier Panis. Let's come back to that. Great sidebar of the championship story. I think it's fair to say that when those opportunities came, like the Monaco win from Schumacher was extraordinary, wasn't it? It was like 4 or 5 seconds a lap faster sometimes.
I was going to say that. I mean, in a way, the weather played its part in making this a championship fight, because you've got the two of the great wet weather drivers, I would argue, at Monaco and then at Spa.
Yeah,
where Schumacher did really make the rest of them look incredibly average, didn't he? I mean, absolutely destroyed the field in a way that we don't really see very often these days, because invariably there's safety cars or red flags, or they don't really get up and running for long enough.
Yeah, but I think, if we look at the season on the whole, I think Schumacher really, he made that season happen, didn't he? There was no one else in, because the McLaren was a decent car. Obviously, Coulthard won in Melbourne and won again in Monza, but actually Hakkinen could have won. Silverstone could have won in Germany.
Nürburgring. They were both out front, weren't they?
They could have both won that race. I think there was a few races, wasn't there, where Hakkinen, Austria as well, I think Hakkinen could have won that race. So there's a few there. So the McLaren was a decent car.
Third fastest car of the season on the pace, for sure.
And also... If Schumacher was in a Benetton, would he have been closer? Would he have been fighting closer? Probably.
Well, he still wins Monaco and Spa.
Yeah.
I was just looking up. He was a mere 6.7 seconds clear at the end of the first lap at Monaco.
Unbelievable, wasn't it?
I mean.
Yeah. But I think, for me, you had a fantastic championship battle. You'd have to say Villeneuve, races like Interlagos, Argentina, he was brilliant at, taking those pole fastest lap and winning the races in Brazil. And I think, he did what he had to do to win that championship. But I agree with you. I would put Schumacher as number one.
So who were we putting third? So on the...
I would go Mika Hakkinen.
Well, Allsport agrees with you. Okay. Hakkinen was third on that one. I'm just scrolling through, and Auto Course would as well. So I think it's interesting because I was thinking of it just, 97, that's an interesting one. DC got the better of Hakkinen that year, two wins. But actually, when you go back and look at all the stats, all the qualifying and the race, Hakkinen was ahead. He was 11.6 ahead of DC in qualifying. He had the two or three, because he led the British Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Would Villeneuve have beaten him? Don't know. Yeah, there are a few times where Hakkinen suffered and Villeneuve benefited right up until the last race, where, of course, they reversed it. They had the little Williams-McLaren deal, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there were definitely three, wasn't it? Silverstone, Austria, Nürburgring were definitely three races where Hakkinen could have won. And that's a chunk of points there, and what that would have done for his confidence and all the rest of it. So, I would go Hakkinen third, probably Coulthard fourth, because it was one of David's really good seasons, I think, wasn't it? The win in Monza was excellent. It was really top draw stuff. In Melbourne, he was there to pick up the pieces. Obviously, brake failure for Frentzen late on. Villeneuve lap one, and DC was there. But the Monza win was absolutely top draw from David.
Yeah, he picked that as one of his best drives when I spoke to him for his greatest races list. And actually, both Auto Course and Autosport agree with you as well with fourth. They disagree on fifth. We won't do the whole 10 odds.
No.
But fifth, they Autosport had Frentzen. Oh, I'm sorry, I can't. You can't have one win in that car. But Bjorn Alesi was fifth in the Autocourse one, which, given that he did overall have a better season than Berger, I think the Benetton highlight of the year, one of my favourite races ever, just because I thought it was such a fantastic personal story of everything that Gerhard Berger had been going through out of races, his dad, the stuff with Flavio Briatore. He comes out and absolutely blitzes the field at Hockenheim with the real one of the feel-good races of the season, I thought. But overall, Alesi probably was the more consistent driver.
Yeah, but I feel like Panis should be fifth. He was brilliant.
Panis doesn't make either list.
That's ridiculous.
Now, is that because he didn't do enough races?
Well, maybe.
He did.
So maybe we should highlight for people who aren't aware of that season why, right? Because so Olivier Panis was driving for Ligier, which was already owned by Prost, but not called Prost Grand Prix.
Wasn't it called Prost? Hang on. I think that might have been Prost. But it was Prost. No, that was the first year of Prost.
Oh, was it the first year of the Prost name? Prost.
Yeah, yeah. And
right,
it had Bridgestone tyres as well, which was key, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The JS45.
That was it, with a Mugen Honda engine.
Yeah.
And it was just a brilliant story, because the Bridgestone tyres, you know, they took a gamble on Bridgestone tyres at that time. And, you know, Panis was the one who made Ron Dennis sit up and think, ooh, I need to get Bridgestone tyres the year after. And I think Benetton as well went to Bridgestone, didn't they? And Panis in Brazil, third, Barcelona. He was chasing Villeneuve.
So close to winning.
Yeah. You know, it was just a brilliant feel-good story. So for me, unfortunately for Olivier Panis, he then had a huge crash in Canada, broke his leg. And that put him out for a number of races. I think I'm looking at 7 races he missed that.
Came back and scored points again in the first race back.
But I think that was a brilliant season from Panis. I thought Fisichella I would actually rate pretty highly that year, because it was his first full season, wasn't he? He'd done a few races for Minardi, but I don't think he'd done a full year.
Yeah. I regard sort of Fisichella and Ralf Schumacher, he was basically being rookies.
Yeah,
and
in a Liam Lawson sort of way.
Yes, that's fair. But I thought they both had their impressive moments. Fisichella probably more so.
Yeah. I mean, they should have won in Argentina, shouldn't they? Well, Ralf should have probably won in Argentina, where they ended up crashing into each other. But Fisichella was great, wasn't he? Hockenheim, he should have finished on the podium.
He should have been, yeah. I mean, I know there are people at Jordan who think maybe they might have won that race, but I don't think they were going to beat Berger in a million years.
No.
So that day, I think second was as good as it was going to get.
Exactly. But, you know, he did a really good job. He had podiums in 2 podiums, I think, that year, wasn't it? Canada and Spa. Spa came, maybe he finished second in Spa, didn't he? So, yeah, I thought, I don't know, I just felt like I have this sort of overriding feeling that the Benetton drivers in 96 and 97 didn't get the best out of that package. And, you know, when you drop Alex Wurz in as a complete rookie, obviously very good driver, but complete rookie, and he's immediately on the pace and finishing on the podium compared to the 2 super experienced teammates, you go, come on, are they really maximising the package?
Yeah, I think they're probably people at the team that would have probably made the same point. Probably wasn't a bad car, was it? A Renault engine, Benetton on that. So his last year of Renault as a factory engine supplier during that era as well. We should probably give a little bit of a shout out, because he did make the top tens as well in both of this. Rubens Barrichello getting that. I mean, the reliability.
Appalling.
Absolutely horrendous, like 1970-style reliability. But it did hold together to finish second at Monaco, where he was the most impressive driver outside of, you know, Schumacher 45 seconds down the road.
Yeah, and it's just a great story, wasn't it? Seeing Stewart Grand Prix come onto the grid and, you know, Jackie doing things the Jackie way, proper. It looked all straight away like a proper team, Ford backing, big sponsors, blue chip companies on board. It was done in the Jackie Stewart style. And it was cool to see that result. It's cool to see them get a podium. You know, but I quite liked seeing things like Jarno Trulli running at the front in Austria. I mean,
in a Prost.
In a Prost. You know, that sort of stuff just doesn't happen these days, you know. And then, of course, the one we haven't yet mentioned, the reigning world champion struggling to qualify for the opening race and then nearly winning the Hungarian Grand Prix.
Yeah, I think it was 5.3 seconds off pole in Melbourne, and it then conked out before the race even really got started. And then as if you go straight to Jerez, he could have been on pole. I mean, that's the ridiculous three, Frentzen, Villeneuve, Schumacher on the same time.
Amazing.
But actually, Damon was on a lap that might have put him, I think he got held up by a spinning Minardi or something.
Yeah, no, it was Shinji Nakano.
That's it.
I told Damon this the other day, and he went, is it? Is that true? I said, yeah. Shinji Nakano ruined you getting pole.
But imagine if you'd had that title fight between those two big teams going at it, and the reigning world champion in an arrows on the front. That would have been absolutely brilliant. But he didn't make the top 10 in either of the either of the autocross or the autosport lists, and I thought
that's a bit harsh.
If you read the articles at the time, they were obsessed with the fact that he got outqualified by Pedro Diniz a couple of times. I mean, it was 14-3, so it wasn't,
I think if I, you know, we talk about my memories of that season and why I chose it, the Damon story is absolutely one of them. You know, this underdog story of the car being an utter dog at the start of the year.
It looked horrible even like watching on the screen, I remember. Yeah.
And then amazingly getting his first point at the British Grand Prix, you know, with the home crowd, and then Budapest happened. And then actually, they had weekends where it looked reasonably quick towards the latter part of the year. But I think you also had, you had stories like, you know, just stuff like Noboto Fontana getting involved with holding up Villeneuve in the championship race decider, and this whole, you know, Schumacher going off to test a Sauber, and just
Villeneuve being allowed to start a Suzuka, but under appeal. And
I mean, Suzuka.
Sort of, I mean,
well, Suzuka on a job.
Eddie Irvine, with his move.
Yeah, exactly. Suzuka, you know, again, for people who weren't aware, you know, Villeneuve basically got disqualified for going too fast under yellow flags and then raced under appeal and then chose to back the pack up, basically. He just tried to drive it on slowly, back the pack up, back Schumacher up, and then Irvine just drove around everybody and at the S's. It was just, I love that sort of stuff. Just some completely bonkers stories.
I mean, if people that complain about the decision-making now, I mean, they have an absolute field day in the late 90s. I mean, there was that. A couple of years later, we had the Ferraris being illegal at Malaysia. But no, it's all right. You're within this magic 5% rule that just got invented. And there's all sorts of nonsense going on to keep championship fights alive, it seemed like, at the time. I suppose we should also talk a little bit about Frentzen, because obviously there'd been a lot of hoo-ha about the fact that he was, you know, he replaced Damon Hill at Williams. He'd been signed before Damon even won the world championship. This guy from Group C, he was the great, you know, the anti-Schumacher, and it just felt absolutely flat, didn't it, at Williams? He was just mentally destroyed by Villeneuve, really.
I don't know if it was mentally destroyed.
Closer than their results.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it was just the level of expectations coming in were obviously sky high, and you'd have to say that, you know, Frentzen and the Sauber had done a good job, hadn't he? 94.
Oh, he earned the right for a top drive, for sure.
Yeah, 94 and 95, he looked strong. And actually, if you look at what he did in 99 in the Jordan as well, he had a brilliant season. But it never quite happened for him at Williams, did it? It just never quite happened. He got closer in 98, I think, but certainly in 97, his first year with the team, Villeneuve just had such an upper hand. I think the problem in some ways, the perception is even worse, because if you rewind to 12 months earlier, you know, Villeneuve had arrived as the new boy into the team and had run Damon for the championship all the way until the final round Suzuka. And that just hadn't happened. You know, you were almost expecting, okay, now Frentzen's a new guy in. He's the one who's going to pick up the mantle. He's sure Jacques's going to be the favorite, but Frentzen's going to be there pushing him hard. And then never quite happened. You know, they were 81-42, as I said before, in the championship. And that's, that's a big margin.
It was 13-4 in qualifying, even.
Yeah.
Which I don't think you predicted that over the winter of 96-97. I mean, I suppose we should say Frentzen's a little bit unlucky as well. I mean, the brake failure at Melbourne at season openers kind of set the tone, didn't it? But then there were things like he actually was the one of the few Goodyear runners to get the choice right in Hungary, and probably actually would have beaten Damer in the arrows, but that's a fuel nozzle thing.
Yeah. He couldn't refuel at the stop.
Sorry, mate, you can carry on, but you just will stop. You'll do as you're on a lazy... which actually was that season as well, wasn't it? Australia. You've got these Benetton pit crew getting more and more desperate on the pit wall, trying to call him in. He just drives around till he runs out of fuel.
Was that 97?
I think so. I think it was.
I'm trying to remember.
I can't remember
if it was 96 or 97.
I will just check. So we don't want to give that wrong information, do we? Yes, it was 97. Oh, retirement reason, out of fuel.
Amazing. There's that sign, isn't there? There's that picture, rather, of them waving the pit board at him.
Yes, they'd given up with the radio and the normal pit board. They were almost throwing things at him, I think. Yes, any other sort of highlights, stories and things you wanted to pick out from... as I say, I think the cars looked pretty cool as well.
The cars...
Over last year, the wide car with slicks.
Yeah, exactly that. You know, I think they... I never liked the look of the groove cars. I just thought, it just looks a bit weird.
It did. And the McLarens were quite nice normally, yeah. Yeah, otherwise.
Yeah, the McLarens were pretty, but I think it was just looked disproportionate. The proportions look wrong. It was too narrow.
So what was your best looking car in 97 then for you?
I actually think the Williams, you know.
Really?
Yeah. I'm not talking about livery.
No.
Like okay. The shape of the car, I think the Williams thing. But in terms of livery, I think the McLaren, because we were all going, oh, Marlboro's gone. Oh, my God. This is the end of the Marlboro McLaren era. What is going to happen? What's it going to look like? And actually it came out and you thought, okay, that's cool.
Yeah. And well, they tested it in orange, didn't they? That looked cool. And then they came out with the sort of two-tone silver and that looked cool as well.
And actually, I have to say, so in terms of pure livery, just because... Everyone had gotten so used to this. It really felt like an end of an era. The Marlboro McLaren team was just all the success, all the history, all the rest of it. But actually, it switched and you thought, okay, I can live with that. And it did look good. And then they won the first race off the new, you know, and it was such a big thing, wasn't it? The first McLaren-Mercedes partnership. Victory, it was like the first Silver Arrows sort of thing.
Yeah, first win since Senna at the end of 93 as well for them. So it was very much a sort of a line in the sand. I think the Jordan looked nice as well.
Yeah, it was.
97, I was quite a fan of...
It was a sneak, wasn't it? Didn't it go the bit and hisses?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, to get around the sponsorship.
The sponsorship thing, that was good. I think also just seeing that... you touched on it earlier, but you know that qualifying in Jerez, it's never happened before. It may never happen again, was it? Like, not just any three drivers, the two title contenders and one of their teammates being equal on lap time. You know, 1:21.072. If you say that lap time to anyone who's got a bit of fever like us, it means something, doesn't it?
I'm just looking at the grid now. Yeah, Damon was 58 thousandths of a second off, despite the fact that he had his. What a crazy grid that was, and a crazy. I mean, we should probably talk about the actual incident itself, because actually Schumacher did the first part of what he needed to do, didn't he? He got the lead. He was in the lead. He's like, right, you have to overtake me. But one thing that Villeneuve was pretty handy at was overtaking. I mean, he'd gone around the outside of Schumacher at Estoril the year before while chasing Damon to try and keep the championship alive. So he was never just going to sit there, was he? And he took his opportunity by going in. I thought it was a clean move. I thought he was enough down the inside to warrant some room.
Yeah, it was a lunge.
Yeah, it was a lunge.
But I think if you think of all of the sort of modern-day lunges we see, it was absolutely on the edge, but you wouldn't expect any difference from Jack. And I think it was a fair move. It was absolutely a fair move. And good on him for having a go, because, you know, Jerez's not an easy track to overtake at. And he just sat there and thought, I need to do something. I can't just drive around behind him because I'm going to lose the championship here. Fair play. Caught Michael napping. I don't think Michael expected him to come. And that's why we saw the classic sort of, oh, no, he's coming. I'm just going to turn into him.
Well, you see the initial racing driver's reaction of, oh,
yeah,
and steering away from the accident. And then the conscious sort of, oh, hang on, and steers back in again, which is why Martin Brundle's, oh, you hit the wrong part of him, my friend, lying in the commentary. But, I was Team Schumacher until then for that. I remember a friend of mine at school was very much a Schumacher fan, and we both wanted him to win. And the Monday after, I was like, no, that was our boy. He's like, no, anyone would have done it. I was like, no, they wouldn't, come on. So, there was quite a lot of debate afterwards as to whether throwing him out of second place in the championship was a worthy penalty naughty or not. But really, for me, it was more about if he'd won the championship, would they have taken it away from him? And I guess we'll never really know. They said they would have done.
Yeah, I mean, taking second place away felt a bit lenient, doesn't it?
But it's sort of meaningless.
Yeah, but I think on the flip side, what else could you have done? I think for the sake of the sport and the sake of the show, you didn't want it to impact 1998. So giving him some sort of ban or penalty for 98 would have been bad for the sport and bad for the show. And actually, if you think of the 98 season battle we had, it would have been, you know, it would have been a real shame. So, yeah, in the end, it felt a bit lenient, but I'm not sure what else you could have done.
One more parallel, of course, we haven't talked about, as well as being the last year of Renault before they pulled out, it was also really the last Williams that Adrian Newey had a hand in before he went off to McLaren. Williams never really quite... They're still looking for that aero solution, aren't they, really, all these years later? And, of course, he rocks up at McLaren, so it's kind of the start of showing how important he was wherever he went, really.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, it was very funny. I saw Adrian at a friend's house for dinner recently. And after dinner, we had this sort of question of, how many world championships have you won? And he couldn't actually remember because... And I thought, God, you must be on an unbelievable level if you can't remember how many world championships you've won.
Because it's the past. I'm looking for the next thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know... And you're absolutely right. I think the impact, we often say there's no way the teams are, they're big teams now, and there's, you know, you've got to have everybody singing from the same hymn sheet, and it's a team effort. But there's no doubt about it. If you look at the impact he as an individual has had, it is unquestionable. And to me, that's why he is the greatest designer in the history of sport, because he had success across so many different eras and didn't get distracted by road car stuff and all this other stuff, right? He, you know, okay, he's done RB17 and Valkyrie and all this other stuff, but it didn't, unlike Chapman, who sort of went down the DeLorean path and started doing all these other things, and really the latter years, Lotuses, they weren't great title contending cars, were they? You know, you had the twin chassis and all this stuff, which weren't great cars. But you look at Adrian and the success he's had across so many different eras
with different groups of people as well.
And, you know, there's no doubt about it in terms of his ability to contribute to success as an individual. To me, he is the greatest designer ever. And I think there's a reason why, you know, if Williams had given him a seat at the table, maybe had given him some equity in the team you know, that's all he wanted, right? A bigger voice in the team around 96, 97. And Damon being sacked was the tipping point for him. You know, can you imagine an Adrian Newey designed BMW era Williams? They would have walked it. You know, 2003, they came close. They didn't have Adrian then. And you think of what success he was having with the 2005 McLaren, for example, or even the 2002 car, which carried into 2003 at McLaren, was a good car. So you just think there's a big what if in the Williams story, that if they hadn't have lost Adrian, how much more success would they have had with BMW?
Which raises the question of how Red Bull will get on without him as well. But that's a podcast for a different day. Although you've made quite a good pitch there for doing a top 10 F1 designers. So I expect you to go away and have a think about the list and come back, and then we can do one of those as well. But thanks very much, Karun Chandler, for sharing your favourite F1 season, 1997. Let us know what you think. What was your best season? Allsport@allsport.com. Drop us an email. We'll be having other special guests picking out various years. But maybe if we if there's one year that gets missed out that you consistently tell us that you like, we can take a look at that as well. But yes, thank you very much for listening. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast.